Medicine Matters, the Springer Medicine Podcast. As we draw 2025 to a close with this final episode of the year, I want to thank all of our valued listeners and, of course, the experts who have given their time to join us in our discussions. As a special treat, we round out the year with a look back at some of the most exciting clinical developments as chosen by our editorial colleagues from the Nature Reviews clinical journals.
Hello, I'm Natalie Wood, and my co-host for this podcast is our clinical director, Dr. Jane Godslin. Today, we're really excited to bring you something a little bit different to our usual podcasts, and not just because there are more speakers than normal. As we're coming to the end of 2025, we thought it would be the perfect opportunity to bring you a roundup of some of the exciting and important things that have been happening this year across a few of the specialties that we cover in Springer Medicine. And we could think of no better people to speak with than the chief editors of three of the Clinical Nature Reviews journals, which are part of the Springer Nature family along with Springer Medicine. So a very warm welcome to Dr. Gregory Lim, chief editor of Nature Reviews Cardiology, Claire Greenhill, chief editor of Nature Reviews Endocrinology, and Sarah Onura, chief editor of Nature Reviews Rheumatology. Thank you all so much for joining us today.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for your time. I'm so excited to hear a little bit about what has been happening in your field over the past year. We're going to start with you, Greg, as we discuss cardiology. What would you say has been the most exciting story in your field this year?
Thank you for the opportunity to contribute today. I think the biggest sort of change that's happening in cardiology at the moment is the recognition of novel cardiovascular risk factors for atherosclerotic disease. So we've known for quite a long time now that there are quite well-established traditional risk factors for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. And these include things like dyslipidemia, hypertension, diabetes, obesity, smoking. But we've now become aware that even when patients and individuals are well-controlled for these risk factors, actually quite a lot of them go on still to develop atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. And this concept of a residual risk has been attributed to, as I say, various novel risk factors. And these can include things like a residual lipid risk, thrombotic risk, inflammatory risk, metabolic risk, and also things like the exposome, so the adverse effects of things like air and noise, light and water pollution, the effects of climate change and extremes of temperature, and exposure to things like nanoplastics and microplastics. And then there's also a genetic contribution, and we're sort of starting to understand the contribution of something called clonal hematopoiesis of indeterminate potential, or CHIP. And then there are things like diet, ultra-processed foods, and the gut microbiota, and also the role that infectious diseases might play in contributing to the development of cardiovascular disease. So there's a whole range of these risk factors, and we're just beginning to understand the effects that they have on the cardiovascular system.
So interesting. And how do you think the knowledge of these new risk factors is likely to affect clinical practice in the immediate term?
So I think the change that's happening is that we're beginning to have to approach patient care from a more holistic point of view. Previously, the disciplines have perhaps been a little bit siloed, but we're increasingly seeing things like the interaction between different organ systems. And it's really good to have colleagues from other clinical reviews journals here today, because, you know, there's the concept of things like the heart-brain axis, or cardio-oncology, cardio-rheumatology, cardio-nephrology, cardio-metabolism, cardio-immunology. None of these things operates in isolation. So we're getting sort of much more working in multidisciplinary care teams and the interaction between previously sort of more siloed specialties.
So do you think that means that we are continuing on a trajectory towards personalised care?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're sort of assessing these risk factors on an individual basis more. And also, hopefully, we're moving away from sort of treating disease to promoting health. Certainly, that's a big thing in sort of cardiovascular medicine, is the idea, and it potentially is a lot more cost effective to prevent the development of risk factors in the first place and promote healthy living, healthy lifestyle, and not treating disease, but promoting health.
So do you think some of these risk factors that we've identified in 2025, thinking about medium to long-term changes in cardiovascular medicine, do you think this is us being able to move towards that preventative model of care?
Yeah, hopefully. I think the more we understand about the risk factors that can cause disease, the better we can hopefully treat and prevent them in the future. And as I say, it's a lot more to do with the range of exposures that we as individuals counter in our day-to-day lives that are really contributing to this concept of promoting health and preventing the development of disease.
And what other notable mentions can you tell us about from this year?
So I think one of the things that stood out for me from a conference I attended in 2025 was several trials presented at the ESC Congress about the cardiovascular benefits of vaccination against infectious diseases, particularly respiratory diseases. So these are things like vaccination for influenza or pneumococcal disease, but they seem to have as an added benefit a reduction in heart failure outcomes. So we're seeing this potential sort of interaction between the immune system, anti-inflammatory pathways, and translating into a cardiovascular benefit. So I think that's really interesting. And I think we'll sort of understand more the mechanisms in the future. And, you know, that's a real thing to look for in the future.
Something to keep an eye on in 2026 then. Anything else on your watch list for next year?
There's still quite a lot going on in the development of drugs to go back to what I was talking about, sort of the traditional cardiovascular risk factors. So we're seeing lots more in the pipeline for traditional lipid lowering and beginning to target lipoprotein little a, as well as sort of the LDL cholesterol lowering. This is the sort of the conventional target. I think perhaps Claire might go on to talk about, but there's a lot of interest in the moment in anti-diabetic and anti-obesity drugs and the cardiovascular benefits of those. So things like SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists becoming very mainstream. And we're also looking increasingly at the cardiovascular benefits of anti-inflammatory agents. So things like the use of low-dose colchicine, IL-6 blocking agents. So all of these things are treating known risk factors, but in increasingly sort of powerful ways. And then just as a sort of last mention, because everybody's talking about at the moment, is the inevitable kind of newer applications of artificial intelligence to help all of these processes and discover new targets.
Brilliant. So, I mean, it sounds like 2025 was a good year for cardiology, but 2026 looks really exciting. So lots to look forward to. Thank you so much for sharing your insights.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for that, Greg. It's really, really interesting. We spoke earlier on in the year about GLP-1 medicines, Claire. So it's really great to talk to you again now. And so I wondered what you would like to highlight for us from 2025 in endocrinology.
Hi. Thank you so much for the invitation. It's lovely to get this chance to sit down and think about in detail what's been happening this year and what's been really exciting. Endocrinology and metabolism is a really broad field. So I've got a lot of things that we could talk about, but I don't think we could have this discussion and not talk about the GLP-1 receptor agonists and that field, because it's been the big story of the last couple of years. And it's advancing at a really quick pace. And so obviously we have semaglutide and tirzepatide that are in use and are highly effective. And there's a lot more research being done now around their effects beyond weight loss and glycemic control, which is really exciting to see mixed results so far around some of those things. But I think there's a lot of potential there. And I think the story of this year has been that research is now moving towards looking at different formulations within that field, sort of bringing in different analogues and different agonists to try and make the drugs more effective and address some of the adverse effects that are seen with the GLP-1 RAs. And so it's been quite exciting seeing some of those phase 2 and phase 3 studies coming out showing that these new formulations are quite effective. Some of them are more effective than the existing drugs in terms of weight loss and regulating glucose levels, which is very exciting to see. And we've also got, obviously, orforglipron, which is the oral small molecule GLP-1 RA. And the phase 3 study results came out for that drug this year. And it's slightly less effective than the injectable formulations. But obviously the small molecule drugs are much cheaper to produce. So the price point for patients and health services is going to be a lot less than it is with the injectables. And for most people, taking a daily pill is much more palatable option than a weekly or monthly injectable. So it's good for patient care as well.
Absolutely in agreement there. It's great for patients to have options because these are lifelong treatments, aren't they? That is the big thing, isn't it? That we're also recognising that patients will need to take these drugs for a long time.
Definitely. I think that's a really important point. These drugs are amazing. They are life-saving and life-changing for many people. But as you were saying, Natalie, they're a lifelong treatment, which doesn't address the fact that a large proportion of the global population is living in a very poor food environment, where it's very difficult to access regular, healthful foods and have a healthy overall lifestyle. And these drugs aren't addressing that at all, and the issues around inequities in terms of financial and time resources. So I think there's a lot more work to be done in a broader context around that issue.
Is there anything else that you would like to highlight? Because I feel perhaps everything else gets a little bit overshadowed in the light of these advances that we've just been discussing.
It definitely does. And kind of, I think linking into the previous discussion, this year has also seen some interesting advances in our understanding of the effects of ultra-processed foods. It's long been known that there's an association between high UPF consumption and poor metabolic health. And we're now starting to see the really early studies in animal models around what the potential mechanisms there might be, like what the actual effects of emulsifiers and food additives are mechanistically within a mammal. So that's been really interesting to see. And then within some of the more core classical endocrinology topics, there have been some really interesting drug approvals this year. So we've had elinzanetant, I think I'm pronouncing that properly. And that's a new medication for treating the vasomotor symptoms of menopause, so hot flashes and disrupted sleep. So we had a year or so ago, bezalintant, which was the first in class neurokinin 3 receptor antagonist. And elinzanetant is within that same class, but it also targets the neurokinin 1 receptor agonist. And that's a really cool story because it's previously for menopause, we only had hormonal treatments, which aren't effective for all of the symptoms of menopause and aren't going to be viable options for a lot of people. So if someone has had a hormone responsive cancer, they aren't going to be able to take the hormonal treatments for menopause. And now we have these two options that are non-hormonal and they're selective and they're very targeted at the neuronal processes that are causing the dysregulated temperature regulation and sleep regulation that's often seen around the menopausal period. So it's amazing, I think, for female health to have these two options and to have a more targeted treatment. So I think that's an amazing advance. So there's also been another drug approval for congenital adrenal hyperplasia, which is a group of autosomal recessive disorders where you have impaired cortisol synthesis. And it's quite difficult to treat it because you're replacing the hormone level. So it's quite easy to sort of swing too far one way or the other. And so for patients where the current treatments aren't working very well, there's now another option called crinecerfont, which is an antagonist of one of the enzymes that's involved in congenital adrenal hyperplasia. So it's really amazing, again, to have more options for those patients. And then my last point is one which is another drug approval for pheochromocytomas and paragangliomas, which are a rare group of neuroendocrine neoplasms. And again, because they're quite rare, there haven't been that many treatment options. It's really difficult to study because there just aren't enough patients to be able to do a lot of work. And so this year has seen the fast track approval of belzutifan, which is a HIF-2 alpha inhibitor that's now been approved for treatment of these rare cancers. And that's again been it's been a long story because over the last sort of couple of decades, there's been a lot of work as to figuring out what the main drivers are for these cancers. And they've finally able to show that HIF-2 alpha is the key driver in the development of these cancers. And then the drug was developed to target that key aspect. So again, a really nice story of how basic research transitions and informs patient care.
Thank you. It sounds like there's a lot going on. As I say, I feel there's a little risk of things going on in endocrinology getting overshadowed by the big story, which obviously is obesity and anti-obesity medicines. So That's really great to hear. Do you have a favourite of those stories or something that has excited you the most?
I guess like on a personal level, as I'm approaching that age, the focus on female reproductive health, I think, is really exciting to see that it's been an area of research, like beyond menopause, but throughout life, it's been an area of research that's been historically underfunded and under-researched. And it's, I think, very exciting to see that there's been a shift in that in the last few years. So now we're learning more, which is going to improve the lives of so many people. I think that's probably my favourite.
I think what's really nice about the stories that you've highlighted are things that are making a difference now and in the immediate future. So that's really great to hear. Is there anything you're particularly looking forward to finding out about, like seeing what happens in 2026?
Oh my goodness, so much. The anti-obesity medications are going to be a continually evolving story. There's also, I didn't even talk about type 1 diabetes, which is another big area of our journal. And I think there's going to be some more exciting advances there. We've already got the first disease delaying therapy. And I think that there's going to be more advances within that around how we can delay the development of type 1 diabetes for as long as possible and hopefully have more effective treatments as well.
Completely agree with you about that and the message getting out there about the need to get people screened. Really looking forward to sort of seeing how that develops.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you, Claire. That was really interesting. Watch that space for more to come. Sarah, let's move over to ask you a bit about rheumatology now.
Hello, yeah, thanks very much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So I don't know very much about rheumatology, so I'm looking forward to hearing more from you about this now. The past year, 2025, what would you say has been the most exciting story in your field?
Well, there's been a lot of interesting developments, but one of the most exciting stories happening in rheumatology is the continued development of CAR T-cell therapy. So it's chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy for the treatment of autoimmune rheumatic diseases. So this is something that was first used in oncology to treat hematological malignancies, but over the past few years, we've seen really exciting case studies in rheumatology. It started with treating like a single patient who had lupus, and she had a tremendous response to the treatment. And now it's being tested in a really wide range of B-cell mediated diseases, and the results have been really encouraging. So what's really exciting is that this treatment can produce a really strong clinical response and even induce remission, often after just a single treatment. And that's a big change from existing treatments for rheumatic diseases. Most of them can't be discontinued without disease relapse. So it would be a big change in the field. And like I said, now it's being tried in different diseases. So we've got lupus, but also systemic sclerosis, myositis, and others. And these are traditionally very difficult to treat diseases. And then in the past year, I would say we've seen developments that have made CAR T-cell therapy more accessible, which hopefully will make it more applicable to a lot of patients with autoimmune diseases.
So what stage is this treatment at? Is it being rolled out in clinics already, or are we still in the testing and trial phases?
It's still in the testing and trial stages. There's still a lot of work to be done before it can be rolled out to a large number of patients, but there's a lot of different trials underway at the moment, so it's a really active area of research. So one of the big developments this year has been the move away from this being like a bespoke kind of personalized therapy that's really complicated to produce and very expensive, to now having the prospect of like an off-the-shelf option, which is scalable and will bring cost downs and make it far more accessible for a large number of patients. So the initial therapies, they were autologous CAR T-cell therapies. So they would use the patient's own cells, and then they had to be engineered outside of the patient's body and then reinfused. It's a very expensive and logistically complex process. It takes a long time. But now we've had studies, especially in this past year, that we can use allogeneic CAR T-cell therapy, and it can be as effective as the autologous approach. So using cells from healthy donors makes it possible to produce CAR T-cells for a large number of patients. And when you have a therapy that can be mass produced, it could cut down manufacturing times and lower costs.
So in the immediate kind of short term, are patients likely to benefit from this? And if so, what are we talking geographically? Is this happening just in the US or is it particularly in Europe?
The first studies came out of Europe. There were a very small number of patients being treated, but it's now broadening out. There's been studies from the USA. There's studies coming out of China, some very important studies, especially the allogeneic ones. So it is becoming more common, but it is something that has so far needed to be done in very highly specialized centers that could support the complex manufacturing. In the immediate term, there's a lot of work to be done to make this a sort of mainstream kind of therapy, but there are lots of different people trying lots of different approaches. they're looking at ways of developing new targets for these cells, or even using different kinds of immune cells, not just the T cells, but they're looking at CAR natural killer cells. So there's a broad range of applications, really active area that could lead to some really exciting developments in the coming years.
And so if we put our optimistic hats on, where do you think this could lead long term?
Optimistically speaking, this could be a sort of revolution in the field. It seems to hold a lot of promise for a lot of different diseases. So the existing therapies are just not good enough. They leave a lot of patients with residual disease activity, and remission is really hard to achieve. But now they have a treatment that's being shown to induce long-term drug-free remission and with normalization of serological markers. So there's no more antibodies and autoantibodies showing in these patients. So it is possible that it could become a mainstream therapy in the future, but there is still a lot of work to be done.
It's really remarkable, isn't it? It's so exciting that actually the advances we're making in medicine at the moment are absolutely transforming lives. So thank you for bringing this to our attention. This is a really exciting avenue. Are there any other notable papers or exciting developments from 2025 you'd like to mention?
Well, one of the areas that's getting a lot of interest is GLP-1 receptor agonists and how they might have effects in rheumatic diseases. Obesity is already a risk factor for developing rheumatic diseases like osteoarthritis or rheumatoid arthritis and others. And obesity is associated with having worse disease and worse response to treatment. But there's been research recently that GLP-1 directed treatments might have effects independent of weight loss. So they might have anti-inflammatory effects or even protect joint tissues. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in that area.
Yeah, I think we've already mentioned in this discussion alone that it's it's affecting lots of different clinical specialties. So absolutely an area to keep an eye on next year and probably for the foreseeable future. And at this stage, as well as the GLP-1s, everyone seems to be talking about modern advances in technology and digital health. Is that an area that's affecting rheumatology?
Yes, absolutely. There's been some exciting developments in how AI is being used to help rheumatology field move towards precision medicine. So there have been studies showing how AI can be used to identify distinct disease subtypes and predict response to treatment. So it's a way of moving towards stratifying patients and find the right treatment for the right patient, which in rheumatology, you end up with very heterogeneous groups of patients whose disease manifests in different ways. And it can be very difficult to find the appropriate treatment. There's a lot of trial and error. And so hopefully AI will be a way to move away from that.
That's really exciting. It'd be so great to have that personalized care for, as you say, these really difficult to treat diseases. Thank you so much for your insight and your time today, Sarah. It's wonderful to hear more about rheumatology and what's going to be happening in the year to come, as well as what we've achieved in the past year. So I will just wrap up by thanking all of our editors for joining us today. It's so wonderful to have the time to talk to you, but also the insights into the exciting work you're publishing in your journals. We really appreciate you giving us your time. And with that, we sign off from Medicine Matters in 2025. Please do remember to subscribe to our channel via springermedicine.com or wherever you choose to get your podcasts. And if you want to stay abreast of the exciting developments discussed here as we move into 2026, make sure to visit the Nature Reviews journals and sign up for their e-talks and follow us on social media. This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals for their ongoing medical education and entertainment. It should not replace the professional advice of a doctor or pharmacist and may not be used as a basis for diagnosis or any change to the prescribed treatment of disease. The views expressed by our moderators and guests are their opinions and do not represent the position of any third parties. The information given in the podcast is subject to change as the scientific field and clinical advances progress.